Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You're listening to a podcast from the South China Morning Post.
Today, we'll have an opportunity to discuss key priorities, both domestic and global, so that China can better understand our administration's intentions.
With the wisdom of the Chinese people, there is no way to strangle China.
Our deep concerns with actions by China, including in Xinjiang, Hong Kong, Taiwan, cyber attacks on the United States.
Well, I think we thought too well of the United States. We thought that the U.S. side will follow the necessary diplomatic protocols.
But we welcome stiff competition, and we will always stand up for our principles.
Had the Chinese people not suffered enough in the past from the foreign countries?
The United States' relationship with China will be competitive where it should be, collaborative where it can be, adversarial where it must be.
That is the sound of two superpowers colliding in sub-zero temperatures with the gloves off. Hello and welcome to the China Geopolitics Podcast with me, Finbar Birmingham, the SEMP's Europe correspondent. But it's all about Alaska this week. We saw China's top diplomat Yang Jiechi and the foreign minister Wang Yi join US Secretary of State Antony Blinken and National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan for what was the first engagement at this level of the Biden administration. For fans of fireworks, this was up there with the Lunar New Year display over Hong Kong's Victoria Harbour. For fans of courteous diplomacy, you may want to tune out now. Our man in Anchorage, Mark Magnier, has spent the past week stomping about in his snow boots and getting the vibe on the ground from Alaska's biggest city. We will have him on the line from his cabin as he winds down from the event with a hot cocoa to get the scoop from the inside. First, as ever, I'm joined by our political economy editors, John Carter and Joe Shin, to talk about the fallout from this meeting. Was anything achieved? Why did both sides feel the need to come out swinging? And what does China think about the first European sanctions since Tiananmen Square, due to be slapped in place on Monday? Stay tuned to find out. It is Saturday afternoon. I'm joined by John Carter and Joe Shin, our political economy editors, to analyse what was a pretty surprising event yesterday in Alaska, the first high-level summit of top diplomats of the Biden era from China and the United States, and there were plenty of fireworks. You're going to hear more about the juicy details of what actually went down from Mark Magnier in the second part of the show, but first let's get a bit of analysis and reaction from our editors. John, how taken aback were you by this summit and how the gloves really came off very early on?
Well, on the one hand, it wasn't too surprising, although the tone might have been, but the substance of what was said had all been said before. The U.S. doesn't like certain Chinese policies, be it Xinjiang, Hong Kong, Taiwan, and China basically doesn't want the U.S. dictating to it about its domestic policies. On the other hand, the tone was important, and it raises questions about the ability of China and the United States to work together, or the worst case scenario is to work against each other even more in the future. For instance, the prospect of the trade sanctions coming off is likely not likely in the near future. I would note that global financial markets were hit by the tone of the talks, particularly Asian markets. All Asian markets fell on Friday, led by the Chinese domestic market in Hong Kong, because they're worried about the outlook for U.S.-China relations and what it will do for the economic relationship. So I gather from what Mark, our correspondent in Alaska, was reporting, that the second day was more constructive. The disagreements remain, but there were some initial forays into areas where there could be cooperation, which is good news. But we'll see. I mean, again, the Chinese previously were talking about this as the first of a series of summit meetings. Hopefully, Xi and Biden to meet in April or May. We'll see about that. The United States was saying, no, this is a one-off, and then we'll take it from there. So it's wide open going forward. Not hugely surprising, but not certainly not encouraging by any means.
Yeah, definitely not. Jiuxin, what has been the reaction to this in China? Like, how's it been portrayed in the media and just from people that you're speaking to generally? Is this something that's sort of shocked people, or again, as John said, are they not that surprised?
Well, first of all, I think the appearance is more important for the Chinese audience, especially, you know, Yang Jiechi used over 15 minutes to lecturing the U.S. side, you know, you have no rights to criticize China. You know, your view doesn't represent the world view. These kind of comments have, widely applauded on Chinese social media and by Chinese state media. The People's Daily, the social media, even produced a photo or a kind of, artistic work, compared a picture in Alaska compared to 120 years ago when the Qing dynasty was negotiating with the allies of eight armies. You know, so it's certainly given the feeling that this is another historical moment that shows, you know, China is no longer being, inferior to the U.S. China is absolutely on the equal footing with the United States, and China can shout it back every time the United States is trying to criticize China over whether it's about Xinjiang, about Hong Kong, or about cybersecurity. You know, China has the full capabilities or have the full rights to yield back, saying, you know, your democracy is in problem. You know, people are doubting your democracy systems. So stop questioning the Communist Party rule of China. You know, you have to look at yourself. But I mean, these are for many analysts, it's clear that this is more for domestic audience. But for the actual results, that although from the final statements on both sides, we can see that there are still, of course, huge differences over important issues. But there are some positive sides. For instance, China and United States has agreed that they will set up a joint working group on climate change. And that's a very positive sign, because this, has provided kind of mechanism for Beijing and Washington to talk to each other, or specifically for Joe Biden's man to talk to Xi Jinping's man in the future. You know, even for their meetings or, you know, for their video conference calls, this has at least made it possible. So there are still, despite all these fiery exchanges, you know, these kind of dramatic scenes in front of the cameras, there are still some positive progress from the Alaska meeting. Finbar, if Washington and Beijing really have no intention to talk to each other, there won't be this meeting. So the meetings happening itself proved that both Beijing and Washington had something to, you know, in their mind, that they can get from the other side, so that they can maintain at least some contacts and communication. And in terms of that, I think the climate change working group actually delivered this kind of expected result.
Yeah. And Jiuxin, there's been so many memes and videos floating around on WeChat this last few couple of days, some really funny ones. And I wondered, is this an event that has sort of seeped into the consciousness of the general public, or, does everybody know about this? Is everybody talking about this? Or is it like in the US, probably mainly people who are watching China and watching politics closely?
No, I think in China it's more of a universal, because this is apparently designed. You see, it's pushed by Xinhua, it's pushed by CCTV, it's pushed by the People's Daily. So the Beijing, the propaganda machine apparently wants people to get this message that, you know, our diplomats are, you know, standing firm in front of them, in front of the Americans. Our diplomats are, you know, earning points for the nation, and you know, the reason behind this is because our country is now so powerful and so strong, and the leadership of the Communist Party. This is a message that Beijing is trying very hard to, you know, get us through. And I think due to the censorship of different views, I think it's quite effective. So if you ask any people randomly on the streets of Beijing or Shanghai, I think most of people will say, well, you know, this clearly seems that China has become a superpower, you know, on par with the United States.
Yeah, interestingly, we'll hear from Mark shortly, but his color piece asking people in Alaska what they thought about this was brilliant because nobody knew it was even going on. I thought that was an absolutely brilliant article. John, what do you think about this in terms of the grander scheme of things? Nothing too substantial achieved, but do you think it's just a net positive to have these guys in the same room? It's better to have a meeting than no meeting at all, even if it's being portrayed in the Western media as a disaster.
Well, again, we need to remember that Biden has been in office just over 2 months, one of the first things he said, in fact, early in January, even before his inauguration, he said, we're going to look at everything. We're going to review our China strategy, and then we're going to create a China strategy. One of the big criticisms of Trump is that there was no strategy behind his moves. And we'll see. That's still being discussed, and they haven't decided on what that strategy is. And one of the things that they wanted to get from this meeting was information. You know, how would the Chinese react to certain questions, and how, both in public and in private? And there's a question, and there's some indication that the very public disagreements, the sharp words, were not carried through into the private meetings, that there was much more of a, shall we call it, a professional tone to the behind the closed doors meetings. And so in the bigger scheme of things, it's too soon to tell. The U.S. is going through this strategy review. The Chinese are trying to figure out, and I assume from the Chinese side, it's the same thing. They're trying to figure out how to deal with the Biden administration. It's very different than Trump. Opening round. I mean, we'll see. It may take months and perhaps even years for us to answer that question.
Yeah, very different from Trump, John, but a lot of the policies are the same. They haven't lifted any of the tariffs. They haven't lifted any of the export controls. They're still going pretty hard. So where do you see the differences between the two administrations?
Well, the key difference, of course, is working with allies. And you'll note that that Blinken is headed off to the Europe next week for a meeting of NATO officials, and I assume that he will give them a big debrief on what was said at the Alaska meeting. And we had the Quad meeting last week with Biden and the heads of Australia, India, and Japan. And so that's the big difference, is that, and we knew this going into the Biden administration because they set it up front that they're going to work with the allies. What results that creates remains to be seen. Again, it's too early days, too soon to say. And I would note from the Chinese side that the Russian foreign minister is coming to town either this weekend or early next week. So the Russians, the Chinese are also reaching out to their friends, and we'll see what it all means in the longer run. As you say, the sanctions are still in place, and it remains unclear what the Biden administration will do with those. I mean, there's an international angle to it. Does it really do you any good economically? But there's also a domestic political angle for Biden. Can he appear to be soft on China? He's already being criticized domestically for his China stance, and so he doesn't have a lot of domestic political leeway to ease sanctions against China.
Yeah, it's going to be a busy week for me on the EU-China beat with the NATO meeting and also the EU Foreign Affairs Council meeting on Monday night. They will adopt sanctions on Chinese officials and one entity. We're expecting to be an organization. And this is related to alleged human rights abuses in Xinjiang. The interesting thing here is that this is the first time the European Union has issued sanctions of these form on China since 1989, since the Tiananmen Square crackdown. And Joe Shane, I want to ask you whether you know this is seen as a really bad point in the relationship between Europe and China. Is this something that perhaps the China side are thinking, okay, it's a few sanctions, we can deal with this? But I mean, it is quite insignificant that these are the first for 30 years.
Oh, it is quite insignificant. I mean, if the European is going to sanction China, I mean, this is a really big deal for Beijing. You know, this is could lead to very, you know, we don't know yet what kind of specific retaliation Beijing will take against European businesses or European politicians. But apparently this is not going to be, you know, end up very well, because at this moment, at today, China, what China's perception is, like, China is now the worst number two economy. Its market is creating lots of business opportunities for European businesses. So it deserves to be, you know, to be recognized and to be appreciated. And, you know, whatever it has done in Xinjiang is its eternal affairs. And even you look at some online commentators, you know, somebody even argued that, how can Germany, you know, sanction China for genocide? You know, Germany, you have the history of the Holocaust and not China. And you know, these kind of course, I'm not saying I agree with these kind of arguments, but these are the you know, natural defensive response from the Chinese public. And also this is a general sentiment among people. You know, how can, you know, the Europe sanctioning China at it's just unbelievable for many of the policymakers and the public.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
It's interesting to read even Zhao Lijian, the wolf warrior of wolf warriors, at the Thursday press conference of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. I mean, he was lashing out a little bit, but he was mainly saying, look, we see Europe as a strategic partner. You know, we don't want to get to this stage with Europe. It's very markedly different language to which he was using in terms of his references to the United States. And, you know, China continually refers to Europe as a partner, even though Europe has now, you know, drawn up this new definition of China, in which it considers it a systemic rival. So you get a sense there that maybe China's is worried about the whole of the West slipping away. They do have a generally healthy relationship with...
Exactly. If you remember, you know, during the Trump years, China trying very hard to say, you know, American is America, Europe is Europe. And China has been trying so hard to telling the Europeans that, you can still be my partner. Even, you know, Washington should have seen me as rival. But it seems all the developments are, you know, against Beijing's wishes. So there must be some frustration and disappointment within Beijing. And this kind of sanction could be the last straw breaks the camel's back. You know, Beijing will say, okay, it, you know, enough is enough. Maybe we should go ahead with, go ahead, whatever, like we have to do with the Europeans. You know, just no way to persuade Europe to be part of Beijing, for a trusted friend of Beijing.
The interesting thing that I can maybe share on background here was I've been meeting with many of the European officials in Hong Kong over the past month or two, diplomats and EU officials themselves. One nation, I won't name the names, but, you know, very industrial European nation, said that over the past 4 years of Trump, they had constant advances from the commissioner here in Hong Kong, you know, the Chinese commissioner for Hong Kong and Macau. And they were always trying to ask them, you know, why are you in bed with the United States, you know, when the United States is such an unreliable partner? You know, China is the reliable partner for you. You know, we're not going to put tariffs on your goods. We're going to keep the commercial relationship going along as normal. Those calls have stopped coming now that Biden's been elected. I thought that was a little interesting tidbit into how the sort of Chinese diplomatic corps have been trying to win over their European counterparts over the past 4 years, because they saw that there was no trust of Trump. But of course, these Europeans were not really likely to, you know, say, okay, we're all in with China now. But this work was certainly going on in Hong Kong and I guess in other parts of the world. But interesting dynamic. John, what's your take on the whole Europe-China thing? Is this... something you're putting down to yet another piece of sanctioning, or is it something more significant?
Well, I mean, as Zhou Xun has said, and you have said, these first sanctions since 1989 are highly symbolic, and in express the opinion of European officials. And they were, correct me if I'm wrong, but they were adopted unanimously by all the EU countries.
Well, they have to be. If they will be adopted on Monday, presumably they're going to be unanimous, because they've been thrashed out by Sherpas in, you know, closed door meetings for the past week.
But the point is, you've got 27 nations, and it's hard to, you know, it's like herding cats. Getting 27 nations to agree on anything is difficult. And for them to agree on this as a precedent-setting move is highly symbolic, and the question is, where does it go from here? If, as you've mentioned previously, these investment treaty, the highly controversial investment treaty between the EU and China, comes up for EU parliamentary consideration next year, and is this the start of a process where that treaty is in trouble, and that treaty is voted down, not ratified by the EU Parliament? And what impact would that have on EU-China relations?
Yeah, my take on that is that this is the start of the process for actually getting the treaty ratified, because the European Parliament is not happy with the labor chapter in the agreement. They don't think it's sufficient, but the European Commission thinks that if it can do enough other legislation on Xinjiang, on Hong Kong, if it can sanction officials, if it can bring in this due diligence legislation, which would essentially ban forced labor-made goods from the European supply chain, then this may be enough to convince the sceptics, the many sceptics in the European Parliament, to vote for the CAI. So I think this is what we're seeing. It's the first step in a way of actually trying to get the CAI done. Weirdly, you know, it's a bit of 4D chess required there, but that's what I see in this.
Well, I wonder about the ability of the Commission to get this done, particularly given how they've really botched the vaccination rollout. Their competence is in question, in my view.
I mean, the vaccine rollout has been a disaster. You know, the European institutions aren't looking very good at the moment. You know, and if China's one thing that where they can sort of work together, even if they can get Hungary to sign on these sanctions, you know, that is significant.
I'd be curious to know whether the Commission has said to China, look, we're going to have to do these things in order to get the treaty passed. So you have to hold your nose and let it happen.
Could well be, because this is the sense that this is what's going to happen, yeah. And, you know, Wang Yiwei, who is an expert on European-China relations at Renmin University up in Beijing, he told me this week that's essentially what he thinks. You know, China has to sort of not get involved in these sort of blow-by-blow things that the European Commission is doing. Of course, they have to issue a strongly worded statement, and they're going to criticize it, of course, and you wouldn't expect any less from Beijing. But they do, I think, there is a sense that, okay, this is a sort of necessary evil if we're to get out the other side and get this ratified.
Yeah, no, we'll have to wait and see. When does the ratification process start?
So in a very European twist, what they did was they signed the deal on the last day of the German presidency of the EU Council. And they will ratify the deal under Macron, under the French 6-month tenure of the European Council. So this was a bit of a carve up by the French and the Germans, where the Germans wanted it agreed on their beat, and the French want it ratified on their watch. Although I wonder whether the French will come to regret that, because, you know, as we've discussed, it's pretty toxic in Europe at the moment. So it's maybe not necessarily going to be something that's going to sail through the parliament. We're going to hear all about these China-Russia meetings, Blinken in Brussels. So tune in next week and find out a wee bit more about that. Thanks to John. Thanks to Joe Shin. Enjoy your Saturdays.
As critical news stories emerging from China continue to shape lives and business around the world, the weekly SCMP Global Impact Newsletter brings you expert analyses and insights on the economics of COVID-19, society, technology, and the environment. Sign up to receive your weekly email at scmp.com/newsletters.
I arrive 1:30 or 2 in their morning, which is about 5 in my morning. I get the rental car and I get the keys, and the lady says, okay, no pets, no smoking, and no fish products. I say, what's that? She said, no fish products. Welcome to Alaska.
I'm joined by Mark Magnier, who is our US correspondent and who this week finds himself in the icy climes of Alaska. Mark, thanks for joining from Anchorage. How are you getting on there?
Oh, quite well. There was a bit of news today where I think Anchorage has not had a day over zero in something like almost 60 days. It's global warming is hitting in strange ways even up here.
Wow. Okay. So you've been following the biggest diplomatic event of the year so far, You were in Alaska for a few days before the start of the event. Tell us about the sort of the run-up. Was there a lot of press around? Were people excited that Anchorage had been chosen as the venue for this high-profile summit, or what was the vibe?
Well, it was actually, I spent a bunch of time going to supermarkets and restaurants and talking to Anchorage natives and residents. And a lot of the reaction I got was, say what? What meeting? I had one guy who said, oh, yeah, I think I heard something about it, but maybe I mixed that up with a news piece on the Vatican. I'm not sure. So the awareness was quite low. And then once they realized it was Alaska, I had some, and these are Alaskans, say, why would they do it here? Which in some way is a very good question, because I think in many ways it was designated here by the Biden administration as a way to not give it the sort of prestige that you would have in Washington, in the Capitol, but they still wanted to have it on U.S. territory to make the point that the Chinese had to come here. And the fact that Secretary of State Antony Blinken was in Seoul, which is 45 minutes from Beijing, and came all the way here so that the Chinese had to come all the way across the Pacific to meet with him, kind of says a lot about how the U.S. viewed the diplomatic theatrics of this thing.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's great. And so what about the did the press corps follow? How many journalists would you say were walking the snowy streets of Anchorage in your footsteps?
So that was sort of interesting because, it was kind of an amazing event that erupted here to see the two biggest economic powers of in the world get into this tit for tat spat. But the expectations on this thing were very low. So part of that was at play. And then the Biden administration worked very hard to downplay this. And there were only five reporters that were allowed on the official press pool on both sides. Then there were some that showed up just by their own accord, but it was a very small press corps, really. I would say probably two-thirds Chinese from the Chinese media, and maybe a third from the Western side.
Mm, great. Tell us about the actual meeting itself, the opening skirmishes of the meeting, probably more interesting than anything that was said in the meeting. The headlines were great. Some of the lines used by the diplomats were also infinitely quotable. What was your sort of take on how things developed?
So in many ways, this was well foreshadowed, because I think the two sides had been sparring in the press for many days, if not weeks, sort of posturing and throwing accusations back and forth. But it's very rare that you see diplomats just break out of the cordon of the decades of training that they have that frustrate most journalists on how they can say absolutely nothing most of the time in very elegant fashion. And yet it all just exploded at this meeting. And so I think probably the Biden administration was trying to score some points before the meeting. They had set some sort of rough guidelines that each participant would spend about 2 minutes with a little presentation of their main points, which they wanted to, probably, as I said, score some points. And then, it didn't go to script and it just turned into wonderful drama with the two biggest superpowers, in some ways acting like children in the schoolyard.
Yeah, which is great. Great for you. Yeah. And was there sort of, as this was unfolding, were you sort of thinking, well, I can't believe I'm I can't believe what I'm saying, because certainly when I was reading it, I was like, wow, that is an event to for the ages.
Yeah, not only that, but I think many, many, you know, news organizations were kind of reluctant to send anybody. This is going to be a nothing burger. And, you know, sort of 101 journalism, go, just go and see what happens. And it turned into, you know, an amazing story, something I think that will be historic. I don't think we're probably going to see this sort of interaction between the diplomats of these two countries, even during the height of the name calling during the Trump administration. You never saw this sort of direct contact between representatives of the two powers.
Hmm. Do you think there's any positives to take away from this, Mark? I know that things sort of did have a bit more decorum in the second day, and the talks themselves perhaps were a bit more productive than the press, the exchanges that the press saw. What do you think each side can take away from this?
So I do think there is a positive. I think they've both laid down their markers. They have, I think they had to kind of get it out. They had to let the pressure out. They have both been getting amped up by their own conservatives in each country. And so I think this first meeting was just a lot of the pressure, a lot of the accusations, a lot of the pride coming out on both sides. Mm. And I think in some way, both of them were kind of shocked in some way what happened, because it was very, very fast that you started to see them recast things. A senior U.S. official, probably an hour after that preliminary press scrum, sent the message, actually, in the talks behind closed doors, we had quite a productive meeting, and it lasted longer than we expected, and we had a frank exchange of views. And then you saw if you looked at the state media on Friday, mm-hmm. Even the Global Times, which is usually out there banging the drum on certain arguments, was talking about how this is a good first attempt, and we did find issues that we can speak to in common and what have you. So my sense is that they've laid down a marker. Mm-hmm. They have identified probably a few areas where they can work together. And they outlined Secretary of State Antony Blinken outlined some of those at the conclusion: Afghanistan, North Korea, Iran. Other areas that are going to be quite competitive and even antagonistic, including technology and trade. And then they will probably both go back to their capitals and try to recalibrate. It's clear we're not going back to where we were. The rules have changed, the game has changed, and I think it will take some time for recalibrate.
So, Mark, I just want to ask you before we wrap up briefly, you said that about two-thirds of the press corps there were Chinese. Has there been any fraternizing between the two groups of journalists at the event?
No, very little. I've spoken to a few of the Chinese journalists, and they were quite quick to say that they it was against policy to really talk very much. Most of them also mentioned that they were not flying in from China because the visa situation has become so difficult, the legacy of the Trump administration. And some of them also complained to me that they were very overworked now because they had had colleagues get tossed out under the visa restrictions and were doing twice as much work themselves. But no beers and shooting the breeze on U.S.-China relations that I was aware of.
Fair enough. Well, we'll let you go back to your beers because you've earned one. But thanks, Mark, for taking the time out of your Friday night or Saturday afternoon to join us on the podcast.
Thank you, gentlemen. I use the term loosely.
Thanks for listening to the China Geopolitics podcast with myself, Finbar Birmingham. We will be back this time next week. In the meantime, stay safe, wash your hands, keep your distance, wear your mask, and if you can, get the jab. See you then.
For more podcasts from the South China Morning Post, head to scmp.com, where you can hear more about technology, trade, culture, and society.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.